Check engine, ABS, or maintenance light on? Take the guesswork out of your warning lights with O'Reilly Veriscan. The service is free and provides a report with solutions verified by ASE-certified master technicians. And if you need help, we could recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Mm-hmm.
Today, we are undertaking a deep dive into a case that feels less like a police record and more like something out of a gothic legend.
Yeah.
The story surrounding Mark S. Mann, who, following his arrest back in 1975, became forever known in the true crime archives as the Doll Maker.
And our source material today is, it's inherently contradictory, isn't it?
Absolutely.
We're trying to reconcile the sensational, the lurid, and genuinely horrifying claims that built the public legend. You know, the whispers, the diaries, the supposed process.
Right.
With the cold clinical reality of the actual police inventory, the official reports, the testimony that actually led to his conviction. It's quite a gap.
That tension is really the core of our investigation today.
Mm.
The Dollmaker case is just fascinating because it showcases how an extraordinarily meticulous private system of control, one built entirely on social camouflage, charm, even legal deception, was ultimately brought down. Our mission is to trace that mechanism of control and, maybe more importantly, highlight the precise point where it finally failed.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, this deep dive is really an essential study in the nature of objectification, isn't it? Taken to its most literal, terrifying extreme.
It really is.
We are forced, really, by the material to look beyond just the sensational narrative of horror and examine the very mechanics of power.
Oh, so?
Well, that calculated thematic shift a predator executes when he moves from, you know, acknowledging a person's individual worth to asserting absolute ownership, viewing a human being as basically an artifact to be collected and well displayed.
Precisely. And the goal here isn't just to dwell on the horror, though it's obviously disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
It's to distill the essential knowledge for you, the listener.
Yeah.
How did this deception actually work? What was the protocol of control, the charm, the wealth, the marriage that allowed this pattern to repeat itself?
Right, the structure of it.
And most critically, how was that pattern finally shattered by the focused resistance of the last intended victim? We really want to center the moment of agency, the action that broke the cycle.
And we must follow the evidence trail, you know, the one established by the police record. But we have to stay aware of the chilling narrative that's woven around those facts.
It's hard to ignore.
It is. And this forces us to analyze how the public sometimes privileges the terrifying spectacle of the process over the simple, tragic fact of repeated disappearances.
The how versus the what.
Exactly.
So to understand the Dollmaker, we really have to start at the beginning of his meticulously crafted deception, the foundation of his entire system.
Mm-hmm.
Back in 1975, Mark S. Mann wasn't some shadowy figure. He was, by accounts, a respected, if maybe slightly eccentric, businessman.
Right, not operating the shadows at all.
No, he ran a bespoke doll shop.
Yeah.
And it was in a well-trafficked, pretty high-end district.
And the shop itself was, well, it was the perfect camouflage, wasn't it? This is where the theme of control really starts to take root.
How do you mean?
His business specialized in creating these incredibly detailed, lifelike dolls, often custom pieces for, you know, wealthy clientele.
Okay.
So this legitimate livelihood immediately established a kind of veneer. Artistic precision, patience, a comfortable familiarity with creating beautiful, inanimate perfection. Stillness.
Yeah, that's a fascinating layer.
Mm-hmm.
His reputation as an artisan who perfected stillness, making his later crimes almost conceptually seamless, it fits disturbingly.
It does. And he leveraged that persona directly into his personal life.
How did he do that?
Well, reports say he was devastatingly charming, highly articulate, seemed financially secure because of this niche, successful business.
Look at the classics, Cezanne.
Exactly. And he focuses attention specifically on wealthy women, particularly those who perhaps possessed a degree of social independence, maybe loneliness mixed with that.
And the process, it wasn't random, was it?
Oh, no, not at all. It was rigid and repetitive, a very precise acquisition protocol, you could call it.
Which is?
First, the attraction. Often leveraging their shared interest in art or aesthetics, maybe meeting them through his shop.
Makes sense.
Then a rapid consuming relationship, very intense, very fast. And finally, the quick engagement, leading almost inevitably to marriage.
So the system relies heavily on Social trust and attraction, not overt force.
Correct. It establishes the relationship within a recognized, accepted social institution marriage.
And the source material clearly establishes this pattern of disappearance, fall in love, marry him,
yep.
And then almost immediately following the wedding, sometimes, reports say, within mere days, they would just vanish. Without a trace.
And that quickness, the disappearance right after the marriage, that's critical. The marriage itself wasn't the end goal. It was the mechanism.
The key step.
It functioned as a crucial legal and social loophole. Think about it. In the eyes of society, even initial police inquiries, marriage provided immediate, convenient explanations for a sudden disappearance.
Like what? Oh, she ran off.
Exactly. She ran off with someone else. She decided to leave town suddenly. She just wanted privacy. They had a fight. It deflects suspicion. Initially.
Okay, but hold on a second. If his targets were wealthy, often independent women, wouldn't the sudden, repeated vanishing of his wives, especially right after a wedding, draw immediate, heavy police scrutiny? That seems like a huge red flag.
You'd think so, absolutely. But we have to consider the legal and social framework surrounding marriage, particularly at that time in 1975.
Mm-hmm.
It often granted the husband a considerable, even if unspoken or hidden, degree of personal and property governance.
Oh.
The wedding ring, in a sense, closed the door. It made the subsequent domestic space a highly controlled private zone. His status as their husband gave him the ability to control their immediate communication, their assets, their whereabouts.
With much less external suspicion than if you were just, say, a boyfriend or a casual acquaintance.
Precisely. The legal status conferred a layer of protection of privacy that he exploited fully.
So the wedding was effectively like a protocol he used to gain what you might call absolute domestic governance over these women.
Yes, absolute control.
Before their subsequent and permanent removal from the social sphere. It basically cemented his claim over them,
right.
Legally transitioning the victim from an autonomous person.
Who privately controlled property, in his mind at least.
Wow.
Absolutely. The act of marrying them was the most effective way to camouflage the terrifying intent underneath.
Right.
It allowed him to operate the core transition moving from life partner to, well, a static collection piece behind this veil of social acceptability and marital privacy.
So this initial phase, it really highlights that the danger wasn't just the man himself, but his exploitation of established social structures,
yeah.
Using marriage itself as a tool for private control.
Exactly. Control hiding in plain sight, using the very institution meant to represent partnership.
Okay, so we transition now from that operational mechanism, the setup, to the ultimate outcome,
yeah.
The display that really fueled the legend. And this is where the police record starts to confirm the horrifying narrative that had been whispered about. The raid on his workshop basement. It did indeed reveal 8 large glass cases.
Yes. And those cases, they are the undeniable physical evidence of his intent to silence and possess.
Tell us about that scene, based on the reports.
Well, the source material details this meticulously arranged subterranean studio.
Right.
And the cases weren't just tucked away in darkness. They were apparently dramatically lit, almost spotlighting.
Like a gallery.
Precisely. And inside, they held 8 figures. The police inventory described them as lifelike, beautiful dolls, which internally, in his diary, he apparently referred to as his brides.
The doll maker wasn't just collecting trophies. He was curating an exhibition of his control.
Absolutely. Those glass cases represent the physical manifestation of arrested time. Of absolute ownership, they are artifacts designed to perpetually outlive his operational period, silent witnesses to lives that were extinguished.
The spectacle of the display is key, isn't it?
It really is. The stillness, the manufactured perfection inside those cases. It was clearly intended as a trophy display.
Yeah.
They represent the ultimate expression of ownership. Perfect. Quiet, perpetually beautiful, and entirely subject to his gaze, his control.
And by transforming the wives into these objects, the maker attempts this total permanent deletion of their individual identity, their autonomy, their voice.
Erasure, that's the core theme.
And this brings us squarely to the most sensational, the most disturbing elements of the case, the claims that really catapulted this story into true crime folklore.
Right.
While the fact of the case is in the police record, the legend focuses intensely on the process. How were they created?
Yes. And this is where things get murky, blending confirmed findings with more lurid speculation, often fueled by reported diary entries.
What did the diary reportedly say?
Well, the diary found during the investigation seemed to confirm his intent. And reports circulated widely that the underlying aim was, quite literally, to turn wives into dolls. This is where we really need to parse the difference between the physical evidence, the dolls in cases, and the narrative of how they got there, the transformation itself.
And the folklore surrounding the duration of this alleged process is, well, it's chillingly precise, isn't it?
Frighteningly so.
Hmm.
The narrative that spread like wildfire through the public was highly specific.
Go on.
The entire transformation, according to these sensational documents and the rumors they spawned, was reported to take exactly 13 days. From start to finish.
13 days, that number alone.
Right. Immediately steeped in superstition, morbidity. But the detail doesn't end there.
What else?
Compounding the horror, the accompanying whispers, and apparently some secondary police reports or notes claim that sounds, specifically screams, were heard emanating from the basement workshop.
Oh no.
And these screams were said to last for 12 of those 13 days.
12 days of screaming followed by silence on the 13th.
That's the legend. That specific agonizing timeline, 13 days total, 12 days of screams, it functions almost perfectly as folklore, doesn't it?
How do you mean?
It generates intense fear, morbid curiosity. It focuses the public's imagination squarely on how the theatrical, almost unimaginable spectacle of the supposed process.
Rather than the simpler, though equally tragic, what of the missing women, the fact that they were gone.
Exactly. The narrative of the screams creates this visceral, terrifying legend. It potentially overshadows the underlying simpler crime pattern. Repeated disappearance, captivity, and ultimately murder, which was confirmed by the artifacts found.
We have to keep that distinction clear.
We must. While the legend focuses heavily on the spectacle of the process, the police record is fundamentally concerned with the inventory. 8 missing women confirmed by the presence of those artifacts.
So the real horror, documented horror, is the pattern of control leading to disappearance and death.
Precisely. The 8 women were victims of man's methodical pattern of control and erasure.
And those glass cases, in the end, they weren't just his private art project. They became sealed records of loss.
They transitioned, didn't they, from being his private trophies, symbols of his power.
This being bureaucratic evidence. Hard proof that confirmed the tragic facts of the disappearances for the official record.
Oh.
Okay, but the doll maker's terrifying sequence, this pattern... It might have continued indefinitely, 9, 10, maybe 12 women added to his collection.
It seems entirely possible given his success up to that point.
If not for the decisive action of the 9th wife, Chloe Knowlott.
Yes.
We need to shift our focus entirely now to her and the incredibly short, just 3-day window she had after her own wedding before her intended transformation was apparently set to begin.
Chloe Knowlott's agency is, without doubt, the pivotal point of this entire case.
Why?
Her survival and the end of his reign hinged not on luck, but on her ability to maintain critical thinking and crucially rigorous observation inside what she must have quickly realized was an extremely hostile and potentially lethal environment.
So what was it? What specifically broke the pattern for her? She only had, what, 72 hours of marriage before the mechanism was supposed to kick in? What detail did she notice that the previous 8 women, tragically, didn't get the chance to observe or act upon?
It was a simple detail in a way, yet utterly devastating in its implication. Chloe didn't just notice the beautiful, lifelike dolls in the basement workshop.
Mm-hmm.
She noticed the specific attire they wore. The crucial detail was that the 8 figures were dressed in 8 individual, seemingly custom wedding dresses.
Wedding dresses.
Yes. And Chloe, knowing her new husband courted and married wealthy socialites who then disappeared, she put it together. She realized these weren't just any dresses. They had to be the actual wedding dresses worn by the missing wives.
Wait, that is beyond chilling. It's the ultimate mockery, isn't it? The dresses weren't generic props.
Not at all.
They were direct, tangible links. Artifacts themselves connecting the display directly and irrefutably to the specific disappeared human beings. Each dress told a story.
Exactly. And that single observation transformed those objects for Chloe. They went from being merely creepy, disturbing dolls into sealed records of the lives that had preceded hers. Proof of the pattern. That moment, the recognition of the stolen wedding dresses is where the wife effectively became the investigator.
It moved her from a general uneasy suspicion, which she must have felt.
Surely.
To cold, hard, factual certainty about the danger she was in.
Absolutely. And her agency rapidly accelerated from that point. Knowing she was likely next, she had to confirm the scope of the threat immediately.
So what did she do?
We know she managed somehow to locate and access Mark Mann's private diary. That discovery was the final damning piece of the puzzle.
Confirming everything.
Confirming the dark secret, his precise, planned intent not just to collect women, but essentially to replicate his doll-making livelihood with his life partners, turning them into his ultimate creations.
The diary spelled it all out. The process, the timeline.
Apparently so. Reports indicate it confirmed the specific protocols, the talk of the 13-day process, the obsession with silence, the purpose of the glass cases as final displays.
So armed with this definitive, terrifying knowledge, she knew her window was closing fast.
It's extremely fast. But she used that knowledge not to panic, crucially, but to take decisive, calculated action.
And that decisive action was the rupture in his system, the call.
Yes. She managed somehow discreetly to contact the police. And she didn't just report that her husband was suspicious.
No, she laid it all out.
She told them he was almost certainly a serial killer, that she was currently his 9th intended victim, and she gave them the critical details, the basement workshop, the glass cases, the dolls, the dresses, the diary, the evidence.
That call completely derailed his meticulous years-long plan. It was the critical failure point.
Absolutely. By making that single, focused, incredibly brave call, Chloe Nolot transformed herself. She went from being a potential victim, the next in line, into the critical witness and the primary actor who initiated the official police record and brought an end to potentially a decade or more of methodical disappearances.
Her observation saved her own life, and her action almost certainly saved countless others who might have come after her.
Without a doubt. But her final act before the police arrived, that's what truly cements the narrative of control being reversed.
What was that?
The sources tell us that knowing the police were en route, Chloe left a specific, very personalized, well, gift for her husband. Left it for him to find, probably in their bedroom.
A gift? What kind of gift?
She left a pair of standard police-issue handcuffs.
No way.
Yes. Think about that. It's profound psychological retaliation.
And
a moment of incredibly powerful symbolic justice.
She was cuffing him metaphorically before the police even got there.
Exactly. The handcuffs ensured his immediate legal and physical confinement was foreshadowed, maybe even facilitated. It directly reverses the power dynamic he had worked so meticulously to establish through that twisted disguise of romance and control.
Wow. She didn't just escape. She actively initiated his capture and provided the final physical symbol of his impending imprisonment. That's incredible agency.
It truly is a remarkable display of clear thinking and courage under unimaginable pressure.
And Chloe's information, it must have been incredibly precise and urgent.
It clearly was. It initiated an immediate police response. The raid on the basement workshop was launched very quickly,
leading to Mark S. Mann's swift apprehension. And the inventory of that raid, what they found, provided the final chilling validation of everything Chloe had told them.
Exactly. The authorities sweeping the workshop found the environment exactly as Chloe had described it. The 8 display cases, the diaries confirming the intent, the tools of his macabre trade.
But there was one more thing, wasn't there? Something that confirmed the immediate threat to Chloe herself.
Yes. The most crucial detail confirming the imminent danger she was in was the discovery of his current final project. Positioned chillingly, almost as if it was waiting for its completion, mid-process.
And what did the record show about that final project? What was it?
It was unfinished. The report described a figure clearly intended to be the 9th bride, a doll bearing Chloe's face.
Oh, God.
Only half transformed. That specific, terrifying piece of evidence validated the severity and the absolute immediacy of the physical danger she was under, but it also stood as a stark symbol of his failure.
The incompleteness of his final failed attempt at erasure. Because she acted.
Precisely. Her agency literally stopped him mid-creation.
Mark S. Mann was apprehended immediately after the raid, effectively completing the precise controlled revenge that Chloe had set in motion.
Yeah. Her plan worked perfectly.
But his final reported words, they serve as such a chilling summary of the motivation behind his entire system of control and objectification. It really cuts to the core of it.
It absolutely does. That statement distills his entire twisted philosophy into one single terrifying concept. What did he say again?
He reportedly said to the arresting officers, apparently with complete chilling sincerity, "I love beautiful women, but I love them more when they're quiet."
I love them more when they're quiet. Wow.
That quote is just. It's a direct, undeniable line right back to the source of his business and his obsession, the inanimate perfection of the doll.
Exactly. His desire for quiet women wasn't about seeking tranquility or peace.
Well,
it was about demanding absolute compliance. It was about the stripping away of personality, of autonomy, of voice itself. He sought control so complete it required utter silence. Objectification made literal.
And ironically, that desire for silence is ultimately what destroyed his system, wasn't it?
In a profound way, yes. The autonomy of one woman observing her surroundings, connecting the dots, and then speaking the truth, making that phone call that was the one variable, his meticulous planning, his social camouflage, his legal loopholes, couldn't control or predict.
Her voice broke the silence he demanded.
Perfectly put.
So if we look at the aftermath, the case transitions, doesn't it, from these violent private acts into the cold, sterile environment of the official record. Mark S. Mann, ironically, is now the one contained, wasting away in a prison environment, surrounded by the kind of strict protocols and lack of control he inflicted on others.
There's a grim justice in that. And the dolls themselves, his former trophies, the instruments of his horrific vision, what happens to them?
They sit locked away, impounded evidence. They are no longer objects of his private spectacle or ownership.
Right. They become sealed, bureaucratic evidence. Artifacts frozen in time, permanently testifying to the erasure they symbolize, and, crucially, confirming the pattern of his victims' disappearances for the record.
They moved from being these private expressions of his power fantasy to being public, documented, undeniable proof of his crimes and his ultimate failure. They're forever bound to the official record now, permanent witnesses to the lies they were meant to replace. Now just cataloged and secured in police storage.
That evidence room containing those dolls becomes the ultimate reversal of his intent, doesn't it? His elaborate display, meant to immortalize his control and silence his victims forever, now serves only to confirm the lives he attempted to steal and the horrific crimes he committed. The objects testify against him.
So what does this all mean? What's the takeaway for us, the listeners, diving deep into this chilling source material?
Well,
the Dollmaker case, I think, is fascinating because it provides this perfect, chilling blueprint of the difference between frightening folklore, you know, the whispers of the 13 days, the screams, the terrifying claims about the process.
Well, legend.
And the decisive recorded actions that actually led to his downfall. The facts on the ground.
And the real insidious horror, when you analyze it, wasn't necessarily the sensational method, as horrifying as those claims are. It was the mechanism of control itself.
Explain that.
That mechanism, expertly disguised as romance, as social commitment, designed specifically to silence, possess, and ultimately erase autonomous individuals. That systematic dehumanization, that was the core horror.
But the lasting lesson, the true power narrative here, it belongs entirely to Chloe Noel Lott, doesn't it?
Absolutely. 100%.
Her willingness to critically observe the details, not the grand, terrifying spectacle, but the precise, mundane detail of the stolen wedding dresses.
The crucial link.
And her subsequent decision to use that knowledge to make that call to the police. That act created the record. It permanently stopped the pattern he had maintained, apparently, for years. Her agency won, plain and simple.
And this story provides such a powerful reminder, I think, that even the most elaborate, controlling, socially camouflaged systems designed to silence and erase, they can be broken, they can be shattered by a single focused act of critical observation, resistance, and the sheer courage to speak up, to break the silence.
The artifacts he created to signify his power now serve as a permanent memorial to his victims and his failure.
Exactly. It fulfills that powerful idea that the truth, the evidence, even if manifested in still, silent objects like those dolls, ultimately outlives the maker's murderous intent. They carry the truth beyond his control.
The final inventory is complete. The records are sealed. The doll maker is gone, contained.
And this leaves us, perhaps, with just one single lasting image for you, the listener, to consider.
What's that?
In the end, after the raid, after the arrest, after all the noise and horror, the only sound left was a key turning in a lock, securing a room deep in police storage full of 8 cold glass cases, holding 8 silent faces that would never look back.